Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for January 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick, LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. My guest for this podcast is Joe Welch, a U.S. trademark lawyer. Joe is recognized as one of the top trademark lawyers in America and has acted for such big names as Ford Motor Company and AT&T. Joe is the managing partner at the Chicago law firm of Padishall, McAuliffe, Newbury, Hilliard, and Jarrelson, LLP. Their clients include such trademark heavyweights as Pepsi, Nike, MasterCard, and Bayer. I asked Mr. Welch to look back at 2008 and choose what he considered to be the most interesting U.S. trademark decisions of the past year. He chose North American Medical Corporation and Axiom Worldwide, Inc., a case involving the use of trademarks in website meta tags and search engine results, and ITC and Punch Genie, a case involving the trademark Bukhara, the name of a famous restaurant in India. I spoke with Mr. Welch from his office in Chicago. Hello, Joe.
Good afternoon, Don.
What can you tell us about the first case, the North American Medical Corporation case?
Well, that was an interesting case, Don. You had two companies that made spinal devices, what are known here as traction devices. And what happened was the defendant used the plaintiff's North American's trademarks in the defendant's meta tags for his website. The trademarks were AcuSpina and IDD Therapy. And the plaintiff had registered those, and the defendant had put those in the meta tags, which, as you know, are the hidden source codes that describe what's in the site. And the effect of that was to put the defendant up at number two in any Google search you did. And beyond that, the search, and you'll have seen this when you do searches, it'll pick up some description from the site, and the search picked up this description of plaintiff's trademarks from the defendant's meta tags. So the plaintiff sued, said this was trademark infringement, and various interesting legal issues came out of that, where the defendant, among other things, said this wasn't use in commerce, so you don't even fall under our federal Lanham Act, and the plaintiff, from the defendant's point of view, had no cause of action.
I understand that the trademark showed up in the description that Google presented after the search, but the trademarks never showed up in the defendant's website whatsoever. Is that right?
Yes, to somebody accessing the website, that's right. It's, as I was saying earlier, it's in the source code, so you could find the trademarks, but as far as you're going to the website and looking at what defendant is offering, you wouldn't see them.
There have been some cases involving, I think, what the courts call initial interest confusion. Was this one of those cases?
This was not, and that's one of the things that's interesting about this case and important about it, I suppose. Initial interest confusion cases, and there are some well-known ones like the Brookfield case out of the Ninth Circuit, the idea is that you're drawn to the website by the illicit use of the trademarks, but once you get there, you find out you're not at the plaintiff's website, you're not at the website of the trademark owner, but instead at a different website. And the concern there is like a bait and switch, where the defendant has deceptively attracted you to the website. And once you're there, you think, well, okay, I'm looking for widgets, and defendant offers widgets, and so I'll stay here and look around and maybe buy what defendant has. And that's initial interest confusion. Here, the court said, you don't have that second prong. You don't get to defendant's website, and this relates to what you were just saying about when we were talking offline about comparative advertising. You don't see anything that tells you that this is not the plaintiff. The court said it's utterly silent on that issue once you get there. All you know is that you're being offered certain products. So the court sees this in this North American cases not being initial interest confusion, but instead traditional forward confusion, as it's sometimes called, but simply likely confusion. People will think that the defendant is affiliated with plaintiffs, selling plaintiff's products or selling products authorized by plaintiff. So it's not initial interest confusion. It's the more traditional type.
And that, I suppose, would certainly be reinforced by the use of the trademark in the Google description.
Yes, that's right. The description in the search engine results of plaintiff's trademarks in connection with defendant's website contributes to that.
And I take it using trademarks of a competitor on a website for the purposes of comparative advertising is all right under U.S. trademark law?
You know, it's hard to make a statement quite that sweeping, but it would seem that it could be all right. In other words, comparative advertising is accepted in the U.S., and you can say, a taste test shows that Pepsi tastes better than Coke or whatever it may be, and identify your competitor and compare against the competitor. Obviously, deceptiveness issues can still come in, a lot depends on how it's done. And in the website context, you don't often see competitors draw you to a website and then when you get there say, we're better than the trademark owner that we're comparing against. What you more typically see is a reference that is truthful. Let me give you an example. The Playmate Terry Wells, you might remember this case, she was a Playmate, and she had her own site to draw people that was unaffiliated with Playboy. She was entitled to say that once upon a time she was a Playmate and to have that in her meta tags, but she was not entitled to overdo it. And in fact, she did overdo it with some wallpaper that had the Playboy brand repeated many times, which would help draw people. So that's an example. Yeah, you can make truthful use of another's trademark, but it's still possible to cross the line.
Given that the court found there to be actual source confusion here, what was the result? What did the court order?
The court affirms on the likelihood of success on the merits. This is a preliminary injunction case, and so that prong, likelihood of success on the merits, is affirmed because, as you say, actual source confusion appears likely. Normally, in the past, that would then result in an affirmance of the injunction at the lower level. In this case, it wasn't, and that's because of I think it was 2006 Supreme Court case, eBay versus Merck Exchange, which was a patent case that I can explain further, but called into question the irreparable harm aspect of this.
I understand there had been a presumption of irreparable harm in U.S. trademark cases once a finding of infringement had been made. Is that no longer the case now, thanks to eBay?
This court and others have punted, as we might say here, on that. That is, sent it back to the lower court and said, you decide whether or not eBay affects your decision here. How does that work? Well, in eBay, the Supreme Court said, listen, you don't automatically issue an injunction, and this was a patent case, just because you find for the plaintiff on the merits, you have to consider all the traditional injunctive factors. And as you know, that includes whether the defendant's conduct will irreparably harm the plaintiff, how the hardships balance. In other words, how is the defendant harmed by the relief, and how does that balance out against the plaintiff's entitlement? And then finally, the public interest. And as that's applied here in this case, in the North American case, the court says that the lower court needs to determine whether, in fact, there is an effect here. The presumption presumption of irreparable harm, as you say, was the state of the law in this circuit. This is out in the 11th Circuit here. And the court says, well, after eBay, we're going to have to reconsider that, but it's not for us to decide in this case in the first instance. We're going to send it down to you, lower court. You decide whether this presumption is the kind of categorical rule, those are the words used by the Supreme Court, the kind of categorical rule that the Supreme Court has said you shouldn't apply in granting injunctive relief, or whether this is something else. And the court said, and, you know, there are other possibilities at the lower court level. The lower court may decide that irreparable harm has been shown and no presumption is needed. So there are different possibilities, but it kicks it back down to the lower court.
What do you see as the main lessons from this case?
Well, this court is careful to be narrow in its holding on the actual source confusion and in its treatment of initial interest confusion cases. But it is an important example of a case where competitors are being told, don't put your competitors' trademarks in your meta tags for no purpose other than to draw traffic. That's deceptive. Part of the case we haven't talked about that is also important is that the 11th Circuit distinguishes and to some extent criticizes the Second Circuit's approach to the use in commerce issue. And that's a big issue here in the States with all the keyword advertising going on. If you use your competitor's trademarks in meta tags, or if you purchase your competitor's trademark to trigger search engine advertising, for example, the Second Circuit has raised the specter that in its view, may not be use in commerce. And the case here that gets talked about all the time is 1-800-CONTACTS. This court, the 11th Circuit, distinguishes that case and to some extent criticizes the analysis of the Second Circuit on this issue. So that's another reason it's important.
How did the 11th Circuit criticize the Second Circuit's approach?
Well, what it did, you know, it was very tactful, of course, but it distinguished the case first by saying, well, that case involved website addresses that triggered pop-up ads and not exactly trademarks. The problem is that the Second Circuit did indeed talk about trademarks, and the particular trademark was in the website address. And so lower courts in the Second Circuit have repeatedly applied this reasoning in saying that keyword purchases that trigger potentially deceptive ads are not uses in commerce, and relying on a part of the Lanham Act that is not intended to be applied in these kinds of cases. I don't want to get too technical, but they rely on a definitional section that defines use in commerce in terms of registration purposes, not infringement actions. And the Second Circuit erroneously, in my view and the view of many others, applied that definition in deciding that keyword purchases and these web address purchases and uses were not uses in commerce. Well, under sections 32 and 43 of the Lanham Act, again, I don't want to get too technical, but the main infringement sections, what they talk about is use in commerce in connection with the sale of or advertising of products. And commerce is defined in the definitional section as all commerce that can be regulated by Congress. So the simple point is that, yeah, of course these things are covered. You're not going to prevent people from suing over deceptive uses of their trademarks, like we just saw in this 11th Circuit case, because we say it's defendant's not using the mark in commerce. Of course they are. It's use of the plaintiff's mark in connection with the sale or advertising of goods. So the 11th Circuit discusses that, points out that the Second Circuit's position is questionable and explains why and explains it much as I just have. So it's important for that because it's another appellate court that takes a different view than the Second Circuit. We're all hoping that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals at some point corrects itself and distinguishes 1-800 contacts itself and becomes aligned with the rest of the country. So that's the second important point, and the third is the one you raised, which is this irreparable harm issue, which is being considered around the country. If there's no presumption of irreparable harm, how do you show it? Well, it's the loss of control of your reputation, as symbolized by your brand, that's irreparable. So, of course, you can introduce testimony on that. But as some commentators have noted, it's really somewhat absurd because, yes, you can have your president or CEO testify about the loss of control of your reputation when somebody like the defendant here is using your trademarks and people think it's you. But that's why you had the presumption in the first place, because we all understand that. You're putting your reputation in someone's hands, someone else's hands, when consumers are likely confused, and that's why there's presumption of irreparable harm. So how that will all sort out, we've yet to see, but it's probably going to be something equivalent to a presumption or a requirement of somewhat superficial testimony to establish this.
The second case, the ITC and Punch Genie case, involved a trademark Bucara for restaurant services. Since 1977, Bucara has been a five-star restaurant in a hotel in New Delhi, India, run by ITC. The restaurant opened or franchised restaurants around the world in the late 1970s and 80s. In 1986, it opened a Bucara restaurant in Manhattan. In 1987, it opened a restaurant in Chicago by a franchisee. In 1987, it obtained a United States trademark registration for Bucara in connection with restaurant services. But then it looks as though its business started going downhill. The Manhattan restaurant closed in December 1991. The Chicago restaurant franchise was canceled in 1997. And between 1997 and 1999, ITC made no use of the Bucara trademark in association with restaurant services in the United States. In 1999, the defendants incorporated Punch Genie for the purpose of opening an Indian restaurant in Midtown Manhattan, and they called it Bucara Grill. In 2001, they opened a second Indian restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. And in 1999, when they adopted the name, the defendants confessed there was no restaurant Bucara in New York, and we just thought we would take the name. So in this particular case, Joe, what were the issues involved? What was the plaintiff asserting as its rights to stop the interlopers or alleged interlopers?
Well, your description covers a lot of what happened, and the problem for the plaintiff is that the plaintiff had stopped using Bucara in the U.S. for a number of years and was held to have abandoned those rights. So it was faced with a U.S. user of its trademark, but no actual presence by the plaintiff here in the U.S. And so the plaintiff tried to convince the court that a famous marks exception to territoriality should apply. In other words, that their mark was so famous that it should be recognized here in the U.S., even though it didn't have a restaurant presence here. And as you know, the Second Circuit rejected that because Congress, in its view, had never endorsed a famous marks exception, and that's something that the legislature would need to do. But the Second Circuit believed that under the law of the state of New York, a plaintiff might be entitled to relief, and therefore it certified the question to the New York State Court of Appeals. The Second Circuit, of course, is the federal court, and the New York State Court of Appeals simplified the issues greatly, and I could explain that if you like.
Sure. I understand the first question that was certified and sent to the court was, does New York common law permit the owner of a famous mark or trade dress to assert property rights therein by virtue of the owner's prior use of the mark or dress in a foreign country. So what did the court decide in that particular question?
What the Court of Appeals said is, an owner based in a foreign country could have protection under New York state law for its famous mark, but not under the famous marks doctrine. What it said was, if a business has goodwill in New York, symbolized by the trademark, that goodwill is protectable from misappropriation under New York unfair competition law. And you don't need to show fame, but you need to show protectable goodwill, what we know as secondary meaning.
Now, perhaps that answers the second question posed by the court. That question was, how famous must a foreign mark or trade dress be to permit its owner to sue for unfair competition? Would the answer be famous enough to have goodwill in New York?
Yes, yes. You don't need to show fame in New York. You need to show protectable goodwill or secondary meaning.
It looks as though the court looked at three considerations for determining whether or not the foreign plaintiff had sufficient goodwill. One of those was whether or not the defendant had intentionally copied or intentionally associated its goods or services with those of the foreign plaintiff. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. The defendant here was shown, not surprisingly, as you would gather from the facts, to have deliberately copied. But the court said that's not enough. And we've seen this in other cases, as I know you're aware, Don, where people have come back from foreign countries or been aware of foreign trademarks and used them here in the U.S. And have not been liable for infringement because the foreign trademark owner didn't have goodwill here, if you want to put it that way. And the person's case where a Japanese mark was used here is one. Fashion Cafe, where an Italian mark was used here, is another. And yes, awareness of the original trademark and deliberate copying of it may have occurred, but that's not enough. And the additional piece of the puzzle is the secondary meaning that the New York Court of Appeals was talking about, that goodwill in this country that would create likelihood of confusion.
Now, I take it in that particular circumstance, the evidence would have to be that the relevant consumer market was aware of the foreign brand. What would have been that relevant market to survey in this particular case?
The people you'd be concerned about are the potential customers for defendant's restaurant, and are they likely to primarily associate Bukhara with the plaintiff's mark, with the plaintiff. And you could show that with a consumer survey, for example. The third factor the New York Court of Appeals mentioned was actual overlap of customers between the New York defendant and the foreign plaintiff. You know, for example, with a restaurant, you could see where you might have a clientele that travels and is familiar with the foreign trademark.
So I take it in this case, the ITC people were not successful in shutting down the New York Bukhara restaurants?
Yes, it was a failure of proof. They failed to show secondary meaning among potential customers for defendants' New York restaurant. All the evidence they had was foreign media reports and foreign sources. They made an unsuccessful plea that they would have submitted additional evidence if they had but known what was required, but the Second Circuit essentially said bunk, didn't believe that because the first time around the plaintiff was trying to show fame under the famous marks exception, and of course you'd be submitting the same kind of proof, and that the lower court also considered the secondary meaning factors under the Lanham Act and in looking at plaintiff's proof, and that those factors are very similar to those under New York law. So that didn't go anywhere. They submitted no survey. You can speculate about why that would be. And it turned out there were other Indian restaurants in the country, in the U.S., in, I think it was Massachusetts, Washington, Virginia, and other places around the world, all using the name Bukhara and without any affiliation with the plaintiff. So that was a problem, too.
I understand there have been other decisions on famous marks that have decided otherwise, that famous marks are protectable under the U.S. Trademark Act. Is that right?
Close. The other well-known case is the Grupo Gigante case out in California, and it wasn't decided under the U.S. Trademark Act, as I read it, but rather under a common law exception to the territoriality principle, and I can explain that if you like.
Please.
That was a case, it was another food-related case, I guess. This time it was a grocery store chain in Mexico called Gigante, very well-known and successful there. And defendant opened two stores in San Diego or the San Diego area named Gigante Grocery Stores. Originally didn't know about the plaintiff, which is interesting. Plaintiff had grocery stores in Tijuana, which is quite close to San Diego, so I think that influenced the decision. But what the court found is that in order to protect consumers from deception, we need to recognize that commerce now crosses borders and that we have immigrants in this country, and of course many Mexican immigrants in California, who in a particular situation may be subject to likely confusion. So in analyzing all this, it decided essentially that plaintiff could well be entitled to relief. It was going to remand it down to the lower court. And that the test had to be more than secondary meaning, because we're talking about a famous marks exception. And the Ninth Circuit in Grupo Gigante said if we just required secondary meaning, then we're treating a foreign trademark's owner's rights just like we would domestic rights. And that is too much. That is too much of a destruction of the territoriality principle. We do have different laws, different interests, and so on in the various countries around the world, and you have to respect the territoriality principle, at least to that extent. But there may be exceptional cases where the fame of the foreign trademark owner's mark warrants protection. So what you have as an interesting contrast with the New York case we just talked about, Bukhara, is the Ninth Circuit finding an exception that the Second Circuit rejected, but in the end requiring a higher level of proof than the New York court did.
Do you see this issue going to the Supreme Court, either on the ITC case or on another case, perhaps with different or better facts?
Yeah, possibly on another case with different or better facts. I haven't seen anything to say that the Bukhara case was petitioned to the Supreme Court. What you're on to, of course, is one basis for the Supreme Court hearing a case, which is a split among the circuits. And certainly we have the Ninth Circuit saying yes to a famous marks exception and the Second Circuit saying no. So that appears to be a split. I don't think it's going to be the Bukhara case. It may be another case. You remember here, it took a number of decisions on actual dilution versus likely dilution for it all to get up to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court said, well, your statute literally says actual dilution, so that's the standard, and we had to amend the Lanham Act to get the correct standard, likelihood of dilution, into it. And that was the Trademark Dilution Revision Act back in 2006. We haven't had the same kind of percolation, if you want to put it that way, on the famous marks doctrine, so it may take a while for it to get up to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, there are legislative initiatives here to incorporate some sort of protection here for famous trademark owners in these kinds of situations. I mean, obviously it can be turned around on the U.S. and has been many times in past years where, we have Nike and in Spain and with a third-party registrant and so on and so forth. The famous trademark owners here have faced this abroad for many years. It is becoming a global economy, so it does make sense to recognize, as the Ninth Circuit did, that some kind of protection may well be warranted, and as the Second Circuit did in the New York Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much for these insights, Joe. Much appreciated.
My pleasure, Don. Thanks.
My guest for this podcast was Joe Welch, a trademark lawyer with the law firm Padishaw McAuliffe, Newbury, Hilliard, and Jarrelson LLP of Chicago, Illinois. For further information regarding Mr. Welch, Mr. Welch's firm, Padishaw McAuliffe, links to the most interesting U.S. trademark decisions of 2008, and information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International IP Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.